Good evening. Glad you're here. And I suspect we will have some other people who will drift in. And as long as they're not rude and interrupt what our folks are saying, we're going to welcome them. My name's Tim Summerlin. I'm president here at Shriner University, and I am very pleased on behalf of the three agencies, if you will, who are sponsoring this event and others like it during the year, to welcome you, to you who may be members of the university community here, to you who are from the outside community and the Hill Country in general. We are pleased to have you here, and the fact that you are here speaks well, I think, for your intelligence and for your sense of civic responsibility. We have a very important topic that is on the agenda this evening, and you can tell it's important because it's a long one. The first event is entitled More Precious Than Gold, the Ethical, Economic, Legal, and Environmental Implications of Supplying 40 Million People with Water by 2050. Now, you see in front of you four gentlemen who are going to give you essentially all the answers to those questions and others associated with them. Now, seriously, we are very much appreciate our panelists. I'm going to let Bob Hickerson introduce them to you in just a moment. What I want to say is that on behalf of Shriner University, on behalf of Texas Tech University, on behalf of Texas Public Radio, three not-for-profit entities that are very, very different, very diverse, but who have in common their commitment to using their intellectual, using their technical resources for the community good. On behalf of those three groups, we welcome you to this evening. We think it will be a very beneficial one to all concerned. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bob Hickerson, who is the Chief Operating Officer for the Texas Tech Division of Off-Campus Sites, to introduce our forum presenters here this evening. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you, Tim. I'd like to thank Tim and Shriner University for hosting this first lecture tonight. We're very pleased to be here in this beautiful facility, and we're very grateful for the audience for coming, because it's very difficult to have a lecture without an audience. While you're thinking about it, if you are stimulated tonight and want to learn more, this is a four-part series. The second lecture will be November 8th, another Thursday night, be held in Fredericksburg, hosted by Texas Tech University at Fredericksburg, and the National Museum of the Pacific War. It'll be in the brand new remodeled Nimitz Ballroom. If you haven't seen that yet, it's really nice, and I think you'll enjoy it. So, now we've got a very distinguished panel of gentlemen who have spent their entire life dealing with these issues, and I won't go into great detail because you have their bios in your program. But Joe Beal, second to my left here, general manager of the Lower Colorado River Authority for 8 years. We learned, didn't realize it was that long. He just announced his retirement in January. Really miss him from that role. Bill West, general manager of the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority. And at the end, Robert Potts, who recently was general manager of the Edwards Aquifer Authority and just recently left to become president of the Dixon Water Foundation. And just to my left, we have the moderator tonight. Bill Jeffrey is a Texas Tech law professor, deputy director of the Center for Water Law and Policy. Now, this is intended to be interactive. We've been advertising that we take questions by email, and we have already received some of those. And at the end of the, towards the end of the presentation, you'll be asked to share your questions with the audience. We're going to try to capture the questions and the gist of the answers and post those on the website so they'll become a resource for everyone, including those who couldn't be here tonight. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to Bill Jeffrey for the program. Thank you.
Thank you. As Bob said, my name is Bill Jeffrey, and I drove down today from Lubbock to wonderful Kerrview and the beautiful Shriner University campus. I'm going to take a few minutes of our program to try to put in context what we're doing tonight. As many of you know, others may not know, the population of Texas is projected to more than double in the next 15 years. It will take many billions of dollars to address water supply issues that are presented by not only the current unmet needs, but also the needs from that future growth. The solution to water issues, though, is not just about money. The issues are complex. The solutions are complex, and our experts on the panel tonight will go into more detail on that issue. A brief anecdote. I started working in the water area on legal issues in 1972. I was much younger, had much more hair in those days. I was started on what I thought was a very simple issue of a wastewater treatment facility serving the northern part of the Lake Tahoe Basin in California. I quickly learned that it was complicated because we were dealing not only with groundwater quality and also surface water quality. That became complicated because land use issues were involved, growth, economic development. We're dealing not only then with a quality issue, but a water quantity issue, water supply. There were competing uses for that limited water supply. There were many different local agencies that were making decisions about issues that were related. There were urban issues, there were rural issues, agricultural, municipal, recreation, environmental needs. The river that we were dealing with ultimately was a habitat for endangered species that were affected by decisions. To make it more complex, not only did we have local and state and regional managers involved, this was an interstate river that flowed into Nevada, so now we have two states. Went out to an irrigation project. We have now farmers and ranchers involved, and that water that went through the irrigation project ended in a federal wildlife reserve. So we have federal managers, and to sort of complicate as much as possible in my first experience, the water ultimately that wasn't diverted flowed into Pyramid Lake, which was a main water resource for the Paiute Indian tribe. So now we have Native American cultural, social, economic issues as well. Since then, I've worked for 35 years on water issues in many different contexts in a number of different states and foreign countries. The issues have changed, the people have changed, the geography has changed, but one thing has remained constant, and that is they have always been incredibly complex. The complexity is the recurring issue here, and added to that is a very cumbersome decision process, especially when the parties involved feel a need to resort to litigation to solve their problems. There are many, in that time, I've been to many water symposia, and often they begin with a quote that's attributed to Mark Twain about whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting over. Probably many of you have heard that, nothing new. The unique twist that I heard at one symposium a couple years ago that we had at the law school in at Texas Tech was a presenter started with that quote. He's talking about interstate environmental water problems that had ended up in litigation, only he left off the last word of the quote. Said it said, whiskey is for drinking, water is for fighting. And is in the course of his introduction to these litigation problems, he commented that he purposely left off the word over because these complex water issues are never over. So that may be the theme for tonight. Solutions are complex, are going to be complex, and they involve balancing of a number of issues, environmental issues, economic issues, social issues, cultural issues. And in the ideal world, these decisions would be informed by the best possible scientific, social, economic, and other information underlying the problems and the consequences of alternative solutions. They're not always so informed, and one of the goals of the 2007-2008 Texas Water Symposium is to provide interested citizens such as yourselves with information about water issues in Texas generally, more specifically in the Hill Country, so that you can be involved in helping shape solutions to these problems. Tonight, if we've heard this, the topic is water more precious than gold, and how we can begin to understand some of these problems. There'll be future programs on the science of water issues, on conservation and public education issues, and then finally on some of the policy, planning, and political issues that will lead to solutions in some of these areas. Realistically, our discussion tonight will just begin the dialogue. at a fairly general level. Next year, the symposium organizers hope to be back with more programs with more details about particular issues. Tonight, we're fortunate to have three panelists, each with experience as water stewards for major water suppliers. The organizers have asked each representative to briefly describe their agency and its mission, but then importantly to reflect on some of the complexities that they face in managing these water supplies, the obstacles that are presented to them, and some of their insights on potential solutions, as well as the role for an informed public participation. We've asked them to limit their remarks to 15 minutes each. We'll then have a brief panel discussion among the panelists and open it up to you, the audience, for questions. With that, our first speaker is Joe Beal. Joe's the general manager of the Lower Colorado River Authority, which is a Texas Conservation Reclamation District that provides electricity, manages water supplies, provides flood control, develops water and wastewater utilities, supports community and economic development in, I believe, 58 Texas counties. So obviously Joe is a very busy man with very broad experience, and we're anxious to hear your thoughts.
Thank you, Bill, and good evening to everybody. Bill gave a pretty good rundown on what LCRA is. We are a river authority, but we're sort of a unique river authority because we also have a sizable electric generation and electric transmission set of assets that that most other river authorities don't have. We're about a little over $1 billion a year in income organization, and that enables us to do some things that not every river authority in the state can do, and I think that's good because some of the things that we do deal with water development, water supply that we might not otherwise be able to deal with. The fact that we are as large as we are also allows us to provide an environmental stewardship that is quite robust within our basin, which I think is good as well. Besides the water and the energy and the transmission, we also have a very large park system throughout the Colorado Basin. And remember that this Colorado River is the one that begins just outside of Texas and flows through Texas. It's often confused with another Colorado River that is not as important to us. As stewards of the Colorado River at LCRA, we are focused on having enough water for the people that we serve. Bill talked about the Mark Twain quote, which is oftentimes used, but if you think about it, water is for fighting over, because what is the one thing that you must have to survive? It's not electricity. It's not having a roof over your head. It's water. And there is a finite amount of water in our entire ecosystem. It hadn't changed for eons, and it won't change for eons to come. We may deal with climate change and all kinds of other things, but the amount of water that is out there is constant, and our population worldwide continues to grow. So you would think there would be tension. You would think there would be complexity as we deal with water issues. And there are, and you're going to learn about that tonight. And I will tell you for sure that 50 years from now, it's going to be much more complex than it is today. There will be issues that we hadn't even thought about that we will be dealing with 50 years from now. 50 years ago, we never thought about endangered species. Today, endangered species are a significant element of water development. Central Texas is home to 6 of the country's 100 fastest growing counties. Williamson, Hays, Comal, Burnett, Bastrop, and Kendall County are among 6 among the top 100 within the United States. Together, these counties added about 2,500 people per month between the year 2000 and 2005. The population in Travis, Williamson, and Hays counties And these are in three different river basins. The Brazos, Williamson, Travis is in the Colorado Basin, and a portion of Hayes is in the Guadalupe Basin. But those counties are expected to double to about 2.75 million people between now and 2030. That's less than 25 years from now. And do the math. That's almost 1.4 million people that are going to be in that part of Central Texas in the next 25 years. How many in here live in Kerrville? The vast majority. If you do the math on this, that means one Kerrville every 6 months is going to crop up in those three counties and has to have the water. They will have to have the streets. They will have to have the schools and hospitals and everything else that Kerrville has. Two times every year, another Kerrville in those three counties. So that's what we have in store for us. And to me, that means a demand on a finite amount of water. Service providers such as LCRA are challenged to plan and build infrastructure in enough time to meet the area's needs. And because of the complexity, it takes a long time to develop a water supply project. Now, I talked about a finite amount of water, and I'm going to talk about water supplies here in a moment. The name of the game is how you develop that finite supply into a usable supply that can be there when you need it. That's what water development is all about. It's not about making new water. It's about making water available when it is needed. What challenges do water supply providers face? First of all, we have a good set of tools to start with here in Texas. We're very fortunate to have had Senate Bill 1 passed back in 1997. That developed a grassroots form of water supply planning for the entire state of Texas. That tells us the amounts of water that we're going to need in the future. The regional planning process gives local communities an excellent forum to plan for their own water supplies, to know the amount of water they're going to need and figure out how they're going to get that water. So from a planning standpoint, we've done a pretty good job here in Texas of getting in front of the curve. Surface water is owned by the state of Texas, and it's managed by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. They issue permits so that an individual or a municipality or an industry or whomever might want to purchase a water right would have the right to use water. The water belongs to the state of Texas. The water in the Guadalupe River flowing through this part of Texas does not belong to the people that are sitting in this room any more than it belongs to somebody in Fort Worth, Texas. It belongs to the people of the state of Texas. And there is a complex set of administrative rules and regulations that have been in place since and have evolved since about 1900 that tell us how we can use the waters of the state of Texas. And that's the water rights process. Groundwater, on the other hand, it's the same substance. It's water. Comes from the same source. It comes from rain. But underground water, groundwater, is a private property right. It does not belong to the state of Texas. It belongs to anyone who can bring that water up and use it. So there's a whole different set of rules that deal with how you can use underground water, and those rules are developing literally as we speak. They have not been around for the last 100 years. They are being developed today, and it is very, very complex. Think about this. You have water in the ground. It's migrating towards a spring, and then it outflows in the spring, and it goes into the river. Well, 10 feet before it came out of that spring, it was private property. 10 feet after it comes out of the spring, it belongs to the people of the state of Texas and is governed in a completely different way. The dichotomy in how water is managed in Texas is a source of a great deal of uncertainty in water planning in this state. the value of water, I think, is also something that we need to think about. If I had a bottle of Ozarka water here, I would tell you that the value of that water, based on what I would have paid for it this afternoon, is about $2.6 million an acre foot. You know what an acre foot is? An acre foot is 1 acre, 1 foot deep of water. It's 326,000 gallons, more or less. And so Ozarka water, you're paying $2.6 million an acre foot. We sell water in the Colorado Basin, raw water coming out of the lakes, at $126 an acre foot. So somewhere in between there is the value of water, which makes the management of water even more complex. There is no silver bullet for the challenges that I think we have in front of us our ability as a state to manage our water. But I think one of the first things that we're going to have to do is to provide basic education to overcome these challenges and move forward on water supply projects. Everybody needs to know where their water comes from. Research has shown that if an individual knows where their water comes from, then they are more likely to conserve that water. And conservation is going to be the way of the future to manage this finite amount of water that we have. As I said, we're going to have to understand the value of water. We're going to have to teach people how to conserve and reuse water. Now, there's a lot of fights going on in Texas today about the use of effluent. That's a nice way to describe what comes out of a sewage treatment plant. And the good news in Texas today is that Texans are willing to drink sewage. The bad news is there's not enough of it to go around. And so we're fighting now over what comes out of a wastewater treatment plant. And the complexities that are involved with defining the ownership of that water are intense and almost unbelievable. Conservation can work. Very, very quickly, the nation of Israel, if you look at it geographically and if you study it, what you will find is that the land mass in Israel is about the same size as the land mass from Buchanan Dam that makes Buchanan Lake Buchanan, down to about LaGrange, about the center of our basin. That's about how big Israel is. Israel gets its water primarily from snow melt, a little bit of rainfall, but snow melt in the Golan Heights. The water flows down into the Sea of Galilee, and then it is used within Israel. Israel has 7 million people with a water system that has a firm yield of about 1.4 million acre feet per year. In the Colorado Basin with our Highland Lakes, we supply water to about 1 million people with a system that has a firm yield of 500,000 acre feet. So do the math. In Israel, they are able to take care of their population with about 40% per head of the water that we use for our population. So we've got a lot of potential for conservation that's out there. Now, that cost a ton of money. Drip irrigation for every single corn plant cost a lot of money. So how can Israel afford to do it? It's a national defense issue with Israel. They cannot rely on food products coming in from outside their boundary. They got to supply it all. And so they do. It's just a matter of cost. It's a national defense kind of issue with Israel. It may finally get that way for us here in the United States. I don't think it'll be a defense standpoint, but I do believe that ultimately we will be forced to pay the value of water in order to have enough water. Finally, the regulatory certainty or lack thereof that we have here in Texas makes it very difficult to develop future water supplies. One of the things that we don't know in Texas is just how much water is needed for the environment. for the bays and estuaries, and for the rivers. And so therefore, in essence, I think what we're going to see in the future are adaptive permits to use the water, where you're not going to be guaranteed a finite amount of water with your permit. It could vary over time depending on environmental need, and that is really going to increase the complexity. Finally, the will of the public to create future water supplies, I think, is imperative for us to be successful in the future. The public has got to know that we need new water supplies, be willing to get behind them, and figure out how to work together to get the water that we need for the state of Texas. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Our next panelist is Bill West. Bill is the general manager of the Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, another river authority, but as you'll hear, is quite different from the Lower Colorado River Authority. Bill also is the president of the National Water Resources Association, which is a national nonprofit association of rural water districts, municipal water entities, commercial companies, and individuals that address water and conservation concerns and the use of water and land resources. So Bill has both the perspective of a manager of a complex river authority and also a national perspective to share with us.
Thank you, Bill. Good to be here tonight to share some comments with you regarding our own issues here locally as well as statewide. My comments will be a mixture of state issues and local issues. I will refrain from talking about national water issues tonight. Guadalupe Blanco River Authority, like the Lower Colorado River Authority and several other river authorities, were created by the legislature back in the 30s and 40s. Next year, 2008, GBRA will be 75 years old. And so many of the river authorities have that type of legacy and have been in place for the purpose of serving their constituents in their respective statutory counties. LCRA and GBRA both have 10 counties that comprise their statutory counties. For GBRA, it starts in Kendall County and goes down to the Gulf, the last counties on the river of Guadalupe, of Calhoun and Refugio counties. Again, you know, our job as charged by the legislature is to manage that surface water resource for the benefit of our constituents. Surface water, as Joe has said, belongs to the state. River authorities and other entities simply have the permit from the state to manage that for the benefit of our constituents. We have permits from the river above Canyon. We have permit associated with Canyon Reservoir itself. And then we have water permits, water rights downstream in the lower basin, all for the purpose of meeting the demands throughout the district. We are small in terms of river authorities, but from the standpoint of complexity of water issues, we have our fair share. But before I get into that, Joe made mention of the fact of change. I like to tell a little story. It wasn't that long ago that three guys from West Texas came to Austin on a Friday to the old Water Commission and made an application to build a dam and reservoir in West Texas. They brought their wives with them, and after they made their application Friday there at the old Water Commission, they spent the weekend with their wives enjoying Austin. Monday morning, they went out to the Water Commission and picked up their permit to go build that dam and went back to West Texas. Needless to say, issuing a permit or receiving a permit to build a dam and reservoir today in Texas certainly cannot be accomplished over the weekend. It literally happened that way. Today, the permitting complexity is tremendous. The Guadalupe River is unique, and I think it's the most unique river in the state, and it's because of the interaction between surface and groundwater. It has more interaction with surface and groundwater than any other river. So from that standpoint, the Guadalupe River and the Edwards Aquifer, and why is the management of the Edwards so important for the Guadalupe? Well, you have the San Marcos and Comal Springs that come from the Edwards that are the two largest springs west of the Mississippi that are the base of the flow of the Guadalupe River. The average contribution of Comal and San Marcos Springs is a little over 300,000 acre feet a year. And that's almost as much as all the cities and industry and agriculture pump each year. While the contribution of the springs during drought decreases as surface water runoff is unavailable, it actually increases in terms of the proportion of the flow that is provided during droughts. For an example, during the portions of 96, the springs accounted for more than 70% of the flow reaching Victoria and almost 40% of the flow that reached the San Antonio Bay. There are seven endangered and one threatened species that live in the Comal and San Marcos Springs. These aquatic species are protected by the Endangered Species Act, and the Endangered Species Act and the springs are very important to the downstream water rights that depend on the spring flow. A comment of planning and supplies. The drought of record is utilized for the planning purpose, and the drought of record is when the natural hydrologic conditions provides the least amount of water for supply. For much of Texas, the drought of record is that period from 47 to 57. Unfortunately, there are some in Texas today that are claiming that that is too severe and a less severe criteria should be used for planning purposes. I personally think that is short-sighted. Future desired conditions, shifting specifically to this area. Groundwater managements are defined as areas suitable for the management of groundwater resources. Although these areas have been in existence for over 50 years, only recently have they really become important. The groundwater management area 9, which covers portions of Bandera, Bear, Blanco, Comal, Hayes, Kendall, Kerr, and Medina in Travis counties, it includes the aquifers of the Edwards Trinity, and the Trinity Aquifer. One of the key responsibilities of these groundwater management areas is to determine the desired future conditions. In other words, what is the level of acceptability of development of that groundwater as determined by the local groundwater districts? GMA 9 is considering a future condition of either 35-foot drawdown in the Trinity or maintaining 90% of the historical spring flow from the aquifer. There are very different outcomes, which on one hand could substantially reduce the flow from the Trinity Springs, which provides some of the surface water in the Guadalupe, or on the other hand, could substantially limit the groundwater use. This process is ongoing throughout the state. Environmental flows, back to the statewide issue, and Joe mentioned this earlier. We've been debating the issues of environmental flows and bay and estuary requirements, freshwater requirements, since 85 in Texas. This last session, the legislature established a process that provides for a stakeholder process on the watershed-by-watershed basis, setting up scientific advisory committees, policy advisory committees, to establish flow criteria for each watershed. That will be provided to TCEQ, and from that, the Texas Environmental Quality Commission will adopt rules for each watershed in each basin. And then we'll have the last component of demand as we try to match demands and supply both for human and for natural resource protection. Water and power. There's a natural link between water and power. Let me just quote you a few numbers. Using irrigated corn requires 785 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. Some other requirements of fuel production. 3 to 4 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. 2 to 6 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of ethanol with a new production process. 2 to 2.5 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of gasoline. Just kind of compare those. That's from a fuel standpoint. From a power standpoint, 0.6 gallons of water produce 1 kilowatt hour of coal-fired power. Nuclear power plants consume significantly more water because they have greater cooling needs. A 250-megawatt coal-fired plant, on average, will use 3.4 million gallons per day. A 250-megawatt nuclear plant uses around 4.2 million gallons per day. Texas, in the very near future, is facing a tremendous challenge, both from the standpoint of power needs and cooling water needs. The regional planning process, again, the recognition of our needs that evolved from a period of drought in 96 and the legislation in 97 that set up the planning process. We've identified tremendous amounts of water needed for the next 50 years in the state. There's various costs thrown around, but some costs from the Water Development Board estimated $30 billion for these water projects. If we aren't able to develop the water and deliver the water to the demand centers, the economic impact of that is going to be severe. And so how will we afford to pay for the new water supply projects, which cost much more than supplies today? Joe mentioned 125 or thereabouts in Colorado. Stored water on the Guadalupe is $100 an acre foot. New developed water in the state water plan start around $700 an acre foot. How are we to do that? There are those that propose that we use the toll road as an example and allow private monies to finance water infrastructure. I personally feel like that there are certain public services that should stay in public hands, and water infrastructure, I feel like, is one. But there's tremendous pressure. I think there's potential for public-private projects, but at the end of the day, that pipeline or that dam or reservoir or water treatment plant needs to be in the hands of public ownership by the state, a river authority, a municipal, or what have you. We have many challenges before us to meet these not only demands, but manage the resource, whether it's a wastewater treatment plant or environmental flows or what have you, conservation, return flows, all these embedded issues that we struggle with in the industry. But one of the things that we've got to accomplish, and Joe mentioned it, and that's public education. We have got to do a better job educating our public such that the public does have the will to help sponsor projects that are needed in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Our final panelist for the evening is Robert Potts. Robert is the former general manager of the Edwards Aquifer Authority. Joe and Bill have both talked about the connection between surface water and groundwater. Sometimes that connection is not well documented or obvious. Robert's former agency, the Edwards Aquifer Authority, is the opposite sort of example. It came into being because of the direct and obvious connection between groundwater and surface water. The aquifer is not only an important resource in its own right, it supports an incredibly important surface water ecosystem as well. And so I invite Robert to come up and share his perspective on these water issues.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here tonight and talk from a groundwater district's perspective. There is a tremendous amount of pressure in this state on our groundwater resources. And it's not hard to understand why if you think about the different way that groundwater is treated from surface water legally in our state. Joe outlined that in his talk. But groundwater is privately owned, and state law, by and large, allows groundwater to be moved anywhere in the state. So if you are a thirsty city and you need water, the quickest way to get it is to go buy that water, however that is, and that would vary district by district, and ship it there. And so a lot of the high-profile and very controversial water fights that you're seeing around the state now are around groundwater because it's allowed to move under state law. Contrast that to surface water, which, as Joe described, is the property of the state, subject to permitting by the state agency in Austin, and the law basically restricts it being transferred out of the basin. So you have the irony of surface water, which is a central resource permitted centrally, strongly being used locally because of the law, contrasted with groundwater, which is a private right permitted locally but can go anywhere. So you kind of have the mirror image of each other between surface and groundwater. And so as this state is growing and there's more and more demand on water, there's a lot of pressure moving towards getting that water from the ground. The Edwards-Aquifer Authority was created by the state legislature in 1993, didn't come into existence due to litigation until 1996, but it was created because of that pressure on groundwater. Bill talked about how, you know, the connection between groundwater and surface water with the Edwards-Aquifer is very obvious. The Edwards-Aquifer is a very unique resource. It is a marvelous resource. It's one of the most incredible water resources in the country. But it's very prolific. It supplies a couple of million people with water directly and then supports those springs at Comal and San Marcos, which, as Bill described, is so important to the Guadalupe River. Concern was in the early 90s, late 80s, that the people would be pumping more water out of the Edwards and it was going to dry up the springs and dry up the Guadalupe River. That had endangered species implications. It had all sorts of implications. So the state legislature created the Edwards Aquifer Authority to issue permits for use of water from the Edwards Aquifer, and our goal was basically to make sure the springs kept flowing, come up with a management regime so the springs kept flowing, and also that we didn't cut off the economic growth of the region that we serve. And we have about an 8-county region from Uvalde County, Medina County, Bexar County, on Comal and Hays County. So we have these kind of two, in some ways, competing goals that we're supposed to do in managing this resource. We are not a water purveyor. We don't sell water to end users. We have permits for people that withdraw water from the Edwards Aquifer. And so let me talk a little bit about what we have been doing these last 10 or 11 years to meet these two goals that the legislature gave us. First of all, as I mentioned, we're supposed to permit withdrawals from the Edwards Aquifer. And that has been, I think, the single most valuable tool in managing this resource for these two needs that we have. The legislature told us how to do it. It was based on historic use. It picked out a 21-year historic period. And if you could prove up how much water you used in any year during that period, then you got a permit for that amount. And so for the first 9 or 10 years, that's what a big part of our job was going through that and establishing what everybody had used and issuing those permits. And the permits are really the basis of our management program, but it's really the first line in conservation. The hope was that once this resource was permitted, it would be used more wisely and could be stretched further in order that the region's economic engine could keep moving and also the springs could keep flowing. And we found that to largely be true. It shouldn't be surprising to anyone that you don't really manage something that you don't measure. It's kind of an axiom of good management. If you want to manage something, you got to measure it. Well, until we put in permits, until we put in meters, there was no measurement of use. Once that started happening, everybody knew how much water they could pump each year. It was being measured. It was being checked. It was being enforced. People started using less water. And that's exactly what the legislature had in mind. We weren't sure how well it was going to work during a dry time, but we got to test that during this last two-year drought that we went through. And we could test it by comparing the use of Edwards water in 1999 from 2005. In 1999 was right when we were just starting to issue permits, and in 2005 we had finished issuing the permits. The 2 years were very, very similar in terms of rainfall. They both started with the aquifer level high. They were both years that had about half the normal rainfall in much of the region. Actually, 2005 was probably drier during the western in the western part of the region. And what we found in comparing water usage in those 2 years was it went down by 63,000 acre feet, or about 14.5%. That was even though the population during those 6 years had grown by 12%. The only difference between those 2 years of any significance was in 99 we didn't have permits, and in 2005 we did. So having the permits in place has already made a difference and helped us stretch this resource further. The second thing that we've put into place that has really helped stretch the resource are restrictions during drought. And it's kind of obvious that when it quits raining, you've got to use less water. You need it more, but you've got to use less of it because there's less of it there. And so we have, over the years, developed rules that put restrictions on how much you can pump of your permit during a drought, and we start cutting back the permit holders during a drought. And again, we got to test those restrictions during this last drought. During the summer of 2006, we imposed our drought management cutbacks, and it was very interesting to see what happened. The aquifer level had been dropping by about a half a foot a day, and of course we measure the aquifer level at several points, but the one that most people think about is the J17 well in San Antonio. And in San Antonio, that's reported daily in the on the weather reports and in the newspaper. I'm sure you've seen it if you look at that. And so the aquifer level had been dropping dramatically, really for all summer, on an average about a half a foot a day. And then on July 20th, it went below the trigger level both at San Marcos Springs and at J17, and we imposed cutbacks. And the media got it out, and what happened was the aquifer level stabilized at J17 and at Comal Springs. It was dramatic, and it started stabilizing on July 21st, the day after it went into effect, and it stayed around, we put the cutbacks in at 650, it stayed around 650 for the next 6 weeks. And I don't know if you remember what August 2006 was like around here, but it was the hottest month ever recorded in San Antonio. We had no rainfall, we had 100 degrees almost every single day, and the aquifer level was flat. The third thing that we do to help stretch this resource, and these are all things that I think need to be done statewide and are beginning to be solutions, because we've got to talk about solutions to our water problems, is we require all of our permit holders to have conservation plans. It's not just enough that they have a permit from us and that they know how much they can use and that they've got cutbacks during droughts, but we also are asking them to look at their system or their use and figure out ways that they can use water more wisely. And that has had some effect. But particularly, I think one of the most important things, and it's been alluded to by several of the speakers before, is education. And again, I go back to this drought that we just went through. The difference in attitude by the population affected by our cutbacks in 2006 was dramatic from the way it was 10 years ago. I moved to San Antonio in 1993, and I remember some of the dry times and short droughts that we had in the 90s. And in San Antonio, and I'll just speak from a resident of San Antonio's perspective, in the 90s, there was widespread resistance to the idea that people should cut back their water use, that they should reduce the amount of water they use on their lawns or anything like that. It was very strong resistance. In 2006, we declared, I issued the order for the critical period cut back. It went in the newspaper. I was expecting hate mail, calls, all this type of stuff. It was absolute silence. People did it. And I'd drive around and I would see people's lawns dying. I would see an occasional one that would seem pretty well watered. But by and large, I was seeing people's lawns turn brown. I didn't hear any criticism about it. In fact, I heard a lot of support for it. And then anecdotally, I would hear about neighborhood meetings where some neighbor would stand up and start complaining about the water restrictions, and the other neighbors would shout them down and say, no, this is something we're supposed to do. That is the only thing I can attribute that to is just education, people understanding, as Joe says, where they got their water and what it means to them to have less water. So it's just kind of getting in sync with the natural system and understanding that when it's a dry time, you got to use less water. And people have done that. And that made a big difference, as I described, in getting us through that two-year drought. It was a severe drought. It wasn't a very long drought, but it was a good chance for us to test some of our systems and figure out ways that we could improve it. But statewide, there are a lot of things that we've got to do. So that is some of them that we've just talked about. But basically, you know, as I talk to different people in our region and around the state, a lot of folks, a lot of cities have done a really good job at cutting back their water use. San Antonio has done a good job at cutting back its water use. It's down from over 200 gallons a person today to about 130. And they've done a good job, and they've talked about that. Other cities have done a good job at diversifying their sources of water. They don't just get all of their water from the Edwards Aquifer or from their local river or from their local groundwater districts, but they have several sources, which is a smart thing to do because you've got different, just like good portfolio management. If something's down, something else might be not down as much. Some people think that if they diversify their water sources, then that's what they need to do. Other people think if they do conservation, that's what they need to do. But if we're going to get through this next century in Texas with the population growth that we have projected, it's going to take everybody doing both. Every city is not only going to have to diversify its source of water, it's going to have to do good conservation. And a big part of that, and it's something people don't like to talk about, is price. There's nothing like driving home the importance and the value of a resource. And we say, you know, the title of this is, it's gold. Well, we don't treat it like gold in the way we price it. It is, there are lots of things, a lot of innovative things that we can do, not just price as a penalty, but also price as an incentive. Water is the most basic resource of our life. Maybe we ought to think about every city providing a certain minimum amount of water for free. You get this much water for free because this is what you need to live, and we're going to provide it for you. But if you go over that amount and you're using it as a luxury, then you've got to pay a whole lot more for it. That would both provide a positive encouragement for people to use less, because people like free things, but also provide a strong incentive for them not to use more than or use it as a luxury. Or if they are going to use it as a luxury, price it as a luxury. But right now we don't do that. So price can be a big part of the solution of where we go in Texas. A lot of interesting issues for us to talk about. I'm looking forward to discussing this further with you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Robert. We're going to modify our sound system here briefly, and then hopefully have a dialogue among the panelists based on their presentations.
If I could, let me follow up real quickly on what Robert just talked about, and it was a thought-provoking suggestion that we price water in such a way that it would influence the way that people use water. Basically, that's what he was saying. And I talked about the value of water having been established at $2.6 million an acre foot. That's what people pay for it at the local 7-Eleven when they buy Ozarka or Texas spring water. Think about water as a food. My outfit is in the business of providing treated water to retail customers as well as doing wholesale. So you're putting a substance out there that someone is going to put in a glass and ingest just like you would milk out of the refrigerator. And so you have to treat it that way as a supplier. You've got to make sure that it's pure. You got to make sure that it doesn't have pathogens in it. You got to make sure that the user of that water is not going to get sick. And so that costs a lot of money to make sure that you've got that pure water. Well, then what do people do with the water when they get it? They drink and bathe with about 10 to 15% of it. They take the balance of it and pour it on the yard. It's like taking milk and pouring it on the yard. It's a foodstuff that is very expensive to finally provide to a homeowner. So the concept of differential pricing, I think, has got a lot of merit, and I think we'll probably see a lot of that.
And I concur, but I have a little bit different take on the free aspect, Robert. anything free people take for granted, I feel like. But I feel like it has come time for water to be recognized as a commodity. We buy and consume whatever, and you pay a charge for processing, delivery, packaging, but you also pay for the commodity itself. We buy gasoline for our cars. We pay for the refinery and the delivery processing, but there's also a commodity charge. Everything else we do in terms of supplies has a base charge for the commodity itself. We're political subdivisions are restricted from charging a commodity charge for the water. Now, if I'm a private landowner that has groundwater rights, or a private landowner that has surface water rights, I can sell those water rights at market price, and that reflects the value of that water. But Joe and I are restricted from charging anything but the cost to treat it, deliver it, store it, manage it, bring it to you. And I think from the standpoint of being able to manage the resource and develop the tools that we need and the facilities, we've got to start charging for the commodity itself. Just my opinion.
Well, I think the price, as I said, has got to be a part of it. I resist thinking of water as a commodity because it is so fundamental to our life, and then that really reduces it just to price. And I want to be clear that I think price is a tool for managing our water resources, but to equate water as a commodity really puts it only in price. And there's a number of uses of water that are priceless. I mean, just as whether it's a spring flow or a swimming hole or a place you fish or just all the things that it is in nature that you really can't put a price on. And so price is, as I said, I think a very, very important tool in managing water and making people take it seriously and take its use seriously. I mean, it's a real shame to think of some of the uses that we put water to.
Let me hit one more thing on price, and then if I could, gentlemen, I'll switch the subject to be something besides pricing. Bill made the point that in essence, within a river authority, you have to make water available at your cost, and you can be challenged by those that purchase the water if you sell it for more than the cost that it takes to have that water. That's the nature of the beast. Unless you have a contract and someone is willing to pay more. However, think about water supply as a business, if you will. If you were making widgets and the demand for widgets was increasing and your ability to create those widgets was decreasing because your plant was getting older, then what would you do? Well, you'd be charging for the widgets an amount so that when the time came, you could build the addition to your widget plant. You'd finance part of it, and you'd put equity in it. That's just how you'd run your business. Well, it's not out of line, I don't think, to think about water supply as a business. And maybe it makes sense, given the fact that Bill West said it costs a whole lot more now to make an acre foot of water than it did 50 years ago. Then maybe it makes sense to begin to charge at a rate so that you can have a reserve, so that you can have equity to put into that next increment of water supply that you develop, and that increment is a cost of supplying water. Think about this. There are a lot of power plants that are going to be built in Texas in the next 25 years. If we're going to double the population, we're going to double the need for electricity. What does electricity need more than anything else? Cooling water. It needs coal or gas, and it needs cooling water. And it consumes a lot of water. The South Texas Nuclear Project in the bottom part of the Colorado consumes something on the order, or they have a contract to consume, something on the order of 100,000 acre-feet per year. That's a lot of water. The electrons from a power plant anywhere in the Texas grid don't necessarily stay within the river basin within which they were created. Electrons that get created in the Colorado Basin get consumed by people in Kerrville, by people in San Antonio, by sometimes by people in Dallas, depending on how the electrons flow. And so think about the fact that you're consuming water in the Colorado, and electrons are being used in three basins over. That's almost the same thing as moving water three basins over.
So therefore, we need to address one of the policy issues of the state, and that's the junior water rights provision, the restriction of moving surface water from one basin to the other. That was one of the policy issues I was going to mention. The other policy issue is we've talked about wastewater and reuse several times tonight. One of the things we need in the state is clarity on the regulations of the reuse. Wastewater, a tremendous asset that we have got to manage more efficiently, and some standard regs would be helpful in that line. And my final comment is we've talked about groundwater, future desired conditions. The consistency by which we manage groundwater throughout the state is a major issue. We're fortunate from the Edwards standpoint. Edwards Aquifer Authority has jurisdiction over all the Edwards, doing a great job of managing it. On the Guadalupe Basin, we have 10 groundwater districts up and down the river. The coordination of those 10 groundwater districts for the proper management of the groundwater underlying the Guadalupe Basin is paramount in terms of coming up with a long-range water plan that fairly balances the use of ground and surface water.
Just to add to that point that Bill's saying, I mentioned earlier the pressure that's being put on groundwater. One thing I didn't mention is that the Edwards Aquifer Authority is really an aberration in terms of groundwater districts, and that we're large and basically well-funded. Most groundwater districts are single-county groundwater districts and are very underfunded, have a budget of $100,000 or less, and don't really have the technical or professional resources to deal with some of the pressures they're being put under and the hundreds of millions of dollars that are at stake in some of the water projects. So as Bill was saying, there's going to be a real need in this state to invest more in effective groundwater management than we've seen. We've been fortunate in the Edwards in that we've had the resources to do our job. Most groundwater districts don't have the resources to really do their job. They can go up against a big water marketer with a big legal budget who will sue them, and you know, they've got, like I say, they've got less than $100,000 budget. They can't fight that. So it's going to be a real challenge in the future of the state.
I agree completely. We're about 50 years ahead in surface water in terms of technology and our science and our ability to accurately measure and calculate and use surface water. We've got a long way to go to get to that same level of sophistication in managing groundwater, and we need that desperately.
You know, one of the reasons that groundwater is perhaps is not managed as intensely statewide as surface water is, if you go back and you look at some of the legislation that dictates how groundwater is managed and how surface water is managed. Groundwater, because it's hard to see it and hard to know where it is and it's hard to know where it goes within the statutes, is described as something that is dark and occult.
If I can interrupt, a fascinating discussion, particularly as it gets into some of these legal issues, but now it's your turn. And I will wander around and bring the microphone to you and ask that, I'm assuming there are a number of questions, so I ask that you be brief.
My name is Dwight Brown. I want to suggest the possibility that waiting for the general public to get educated may not work fast enough. What I'm proposing is taking a look at the Railroad Commission, for example. Nobody knows why it works. It works because the users want it to work. And if we could mobilize the users of water, municipalities, big business, all the people who depend on water future, we might get a commission at the state level that has the same authority that the Railroad Commission does. It'll regulate itself because the users want it to be regulated.
Hey, thoughts on that panel?
A well-educated public is critical to this.
And again, as you ask a question, please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Casey Kovacs, and I represent a group in a very small community just south of here on the Guadalupe River Center Point. We have a situation there with some gravel pits and quarries and rock crushers, and I'm going to address my questions to Mr. Beal, since I'm going to cite a study by the Lower Colorado River Authority about that issue, and Mr. West, because you expressed concerns about how this Upper Guadalupe River affects the Comal and San Marcos Springs. But the Lower Colorado River Authority did a study a few years ago about sand and gravel mining and how they affect the have effects on the floodplains and the changing of the river flows. And based on that study, they implemented some more stringent policies on businesses in obtaining permits to operate in the Lower Colorado River Authority area. More stringent restrictions or qualifications or things they had to comply with than what TCEQ, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, requires, which is next to nothing. I'm fighting a rock crusher air quality permit by a business in Center Point on the Guadalupe River. My concern is what this is doing, the problems it may be causing downstream and into the river and the quality, the volume of water that they need to pump both out of the river and out of the aquifer to operate this business. They're big water issues to me, and I can't get much support or help from anybody to fight this.
I'll be happy to attempt to respond to you quickly in terms of the, and this sounds like a bureaucrat, it's not meant to be, but in terms of the responsibilities of LCRA to a rock crusher at Center Point, which is in the Guadalupe Basin, we don't have any responsibility. But the study that you talked about dealt with rock crushers in the Highland Lakes area, particularly near Marble Falls. The controls that you speak of are a non-point source pollution control ordinance that LCRA enacted to protect the quality of the water that flows into the Highland Lakes. It is, in essence, a series of controls that ensures that the water, the stormwater that does run off from these various industrial facilities, meet certain quality requirements before they come into the river. Any river authority can enact those kinds of non-point source pollution control requirements if they determine that they need to protect the water quality from a drinking water supply standpoint, and that's the legal nexus that you have in order to create that kind of pollution control ordinance. But we do have them in place up in the Colorado.
William, would you like to address that?
I shall. I was there when we put the non-point source ordinance in place. We are looking at that issue. We have a cooperative effort between USGS and the Cow Creek Groundwater District looking at the gain-loss situation, base flow in that stretch of the river, well, all of Kendall County and Kerr County. And part of that study is looking at the implications of that sand and gravel operation. We do not have a non-point source ordinance. LCRA's got a non-point source ordinance along with a hazardous waste control ordinance. We don't have either one of those. We are looking at that issue. Yes, Debbie Magin. Debbie Magin. She's in charge of our environmental program.
I'm Diana Deaton. I'd just like to know who regulates the wastewater, and Are we getting any closer to being able to reuse our waste, the gray water? I mean, you talked about how we only use about 10% for drinking and bathing. The rest of our water, I mean, we're using the good stuff. So are we getting any closer to being able to use the gray water for our yards or washing cars or washing our dogs or whatever?
I'll give a shot at that. Yes, I think we are. GBRA is looking at retail operations where you basically have two water systems, a fresh water system and a gray water system for the whole subdivision. So each house is double plumbed such that for drinking and bathing you have one supply and then you use gray water for everything else. I think you will see that starting to be commonplace in the Hill Country. It may take a while, but I think we're going to get there. We need some support on the state level to support that sort of thing with some of the plumbing regulations, but that is definitely moving in that direction.
One of the reasons that you're seeing San Antonio with such a dramatic reduction in its per capita consumption is the robust reuse program that they have in place today. If you drive around the city of San Antonio, you'll see purple pipe strung out in various places on construction sites. Large and small diameter pipe, purple in color. That purple denotes that it's used for treated wastewater effluent. And the city of San Antonio has done a fantastic job of creating situations where they can reuse that water. The LCRA up in Williamson County operates a very large regional wastewater treatment system up there. And we are taking treated wastewater effluent and piping it all around the county, using it so that they can reduce the amount of fresh water that they need to take out of the river system. It finally gets to cost. It costs a lot more to take treated wastewater effluent and reuse it in a community than it does to take treated water coming out of the normal water system. It costs more. So another reason why you might want to price your water in such a way that people would want to reuse the water rather than let it go into the sewage treatment plant.
Hi, my name is Christy Muse, and I work for the Hill Country Alliance. The woman's question here regarding CenterPoint really raised a different issue, and that's the land use issue. And with the amount of population increase that we're experiencing, it is so staggering. My question is, you know, there is regional planning going on that talks about various scenarios of how we're going to distribute the population that we're having. It does show that it makes some sense to look at population and land use because you can do better, more efficient water planning. And I'm curious what your opinions are about, are we reaching a point with the population increase where Texas needs to see a shift in land use policy?
Excellent statewide policy question. I think Joe will echo it. GBRA is looking at the land use issue, the impervious cover issue on the Guadalupe Basin, both from a water quality standpoint and a water quantity standpoint. The runoff characteristics are changing daily. It is an issue we are very much concerned with and are looking at various options and working with each county government in terms of that issue. And I will assure you each county has a little bit different view of that issue. And so the answer is associated with interaction with a number of entities to address that issue, not just one single entity.
Christy, that is a great question. And I personally am a great proponent of land use control for efficiency and for folks to know what's going to go on around them so they're not surprised when they think that their future condition is going to be one thing and it's something else because of a different land use. However, I believe that land use controls should reside at the lowest level of government possible, and I think that those controls should reside at a form of government where the governing body is elected by the people. Unfortunately, in a river authority, our governing body is appointed by the governor. Not that that's bad, and not that they don't do a great job. But I think if somebody's going to have the ability to control the way a Texan can use their land, that ultimately that person needs to be elected by the people who are giving him or her the right to control the use of the land. But I think we need expanded land use controls in the state of Texas. It makes no sense to have a very large city be able to plan and efficiently provide for its population, and you step across an ETJ line and get into a county and there be no land use controls. That doesn't make sense to me.
I totally agree, and that's why I made reference to the local county government officials being involved in the process.
Hi, Tom Arsufi, Texas Tech University. All three of you commented that education is one of the solutions to dealing with the growing population and water supply. Would you care to clarify about what you mean by education? It's a pretty broad term, and it covers an awful lot of territory, and we got all kinds of age groups. Could you comment about specific kinds of projects along education?
Well, GBRA and most river authorities have a pretty aggressive education program, and to be candid with you, we are focusing on the youth. We feel like that if we can get that point across to the youth, they will grow up better attuned to the issues and more willing to be a better steward than some of us older people that it's a little hard to train, to be candid with you. And we think that's where our best focus is. But being said, we've got a population, older population, that we have got to do a better job. We have failed as utility managers communicating with the public the degree of problems associated with our resource management.
I agree with Bill on training the youth, and we do the same thing. We try to get to them young because we know when they go home to sit with the family at dinner, assuming that they do and don't sit in front of the TV, that they'll talk about their experience that day of what they saw and what they learned about the river, and maybe some of it will rub off. But we also have a program to teach people in the Colorado Basin where their water supply comes from. I mentioned that a few minutes ago. It's called the Water IQ program. Do you know where your water comes from? And we use billboards, we use TV ads, newspaper ads, ads at the pump when you fill your car up, explaining to people that the Colorado River and the Highland Lakes is the primary water supply for the Austin area. We did a bunch of polling, and the good news is we learned that about 80% of the people in the Austin area know where their water comes from. About 60% of those thought it came from Barton Springs. So if people know that there is a finite amount of water in the Highland Lakes, they will conserve. Research has shown that. So we're putting a lot of money into the Water IQ program. Other areas of the state of Texas are coordinating with us and doing the same thing. It's happening up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area and some other areas as well. So we're hitting the youth on the need to have clean water and clean rivers and to conserve, and we're hitting the grown-ups on just the basic knowledge of where their water comes from.
I mentioned earlier about the public acceptance for the drought restrictions, and I think that is largely a matter of education. And a big part of that is good journalism and having journalists that understand the water issues well enough to explain it in the newspapers or on the newscasts. It makes a huge difference. I can't tell you how many newscasts I've seen of water events that I was at that they got not just wrong, but 180 degrees wrong. So that's an important part of education. As I mentioned, folks in the Edwards Aquifer region have a high understanding of where their water comes from, and therefore they've been more willing to cut back. And then also to kind of go to the land use issue, because they know where their water comes from and because they know that it recharges close to them, the folks in San Antonio have been willing to tax themselves to protect that resource. They've now twice voted in an eighth of a cent sales tax to buy land or to buy conservation easements over the recharge zone in order to protect their source of water. The first one of those happened in 2000. I was working on it when I was at the Nature Conservancy on the nonprofit side, and it was It was not on the ballot we wanted. It was a May ballot. As you know, May ballots tend to be poorly tended. It was on the same ballot as a rail proposal, which had overwhelming opposition to. There were six things on the ballot that May, and the only one that passed, and it passed overwhelmingly, was for San Antonio to tax itself to set aside land or protect land over the recharge zone. So it has all sorts of implications, not just on the water quantity side, but also on the land use and water quality side, if people know where they get their water.
We're almost near the end, but let's try to squeeze in a couple quick questions.
Bill Dunn, Kerrville. You told us how blessed Texas is to have water supplies for right now. And then you told us about, in, I think it was 15 years, things are going to, population will double and we're going to need more power plants. Has any thought been given to building with the power plants, desalination plants, and take advantage of the water in the Gulf?
Yes, sir. There's been lots of folks looking at desal. The state has a broad initiative, pilot plant down in the valley, trying to work on some of the technology bugs. Desal plants on a small scale are fairly efficient. When you get to large scale, the cost eats you up. GBRA is currently negotiating with a nuclear power plant to supply them water at the end of the river. One of the elements that's on the table in the negotiation process is the possibility of a desal plant on the backside of that nuke.
I got a great idea for desal. It's a lot cheaper to desalt brackish underground water than it is ocean water or bay water, a whole lot cheaper. Less salt you have in the water, the less you got to take out. The driver of cost on desal is energy, the cost of energy. We've got all this wind power out in West Texas, and I think Texas Tech is working on this. We got all this wind power out in West Texas. It's available when the wind blows, and a lot of times the wind blows when the demand is not there, and nobody's figured out a battery yet to store that wind power. And so in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, in the middle of the day, when everybody's at work and not using very much energy, the wind's just blowing like a by God out in West Texas. And you got all that energy that really didn't have a place to go. I think Texas Tech is looking at, and there is a 345 kV transmission line that comes right through the Permian Basin, comes right through a brackish underground water supply. Why not take some of that wind power that's not being used efficiently, put desal plants in West Texas, and let that water run into the Guadalupe or into the Colorado and become surface water to the state?
And you're right, Texas Tech's Wind Science Center and College of Engineering are looking at that very question and have research in that area. One more question. I think we're over time, but let's indulge.
I'm George Kay from Kerrville, and I'm representing the Nature Center in line with this education. We are presently setting up collecting water from your rooftops and all this sort of thing, so that we have a place where people can go and see how it is done on a local level.
So rainwater harvesting is a whole other area that we haven't touched on.
Well, it is a vehicle for the Hill Country. There's no question about that.
We're unfortunately out of time. I want to, on behalf of the organizers, Schreiner University, Texas Tech University, and Texas Public Radio, thank the panelists for not only their time, but their thoughtful insights. We certainly have a lot to take away and think about. I also want to thank you, the audience, for caring enough about this issue to come tonight. I want to invite you to the next program, which is November 8th at Texas Tech's Fredericksburg campus, where there will be another panel talking about the science of water issues. And then there are two more programs that are on the website. The dates and locations are there. And encourage you to come to those as well. With that, I'll turn it over to Bob Hickerson.